Ja, das ist wichtig. Meckern nix. Okay, and so I'll be very brief here. So let's consider a particle motion. Particle motion. So if you draw a space-time diagram, you have CT here, you have x here, and there's some trajectory swept by a particle in your space-time. So now I can parameterize this trajectory by my coordinates, and these coordinates will be function of some parameter lambda. So basically lambda, so it can be, for example, a proper time of the particle. So you know, particle carries this hair a clock, and this clock ticks and shows you at one at t equal to 0 I'm here, at t equal to 1 I'm here, blah blah blah. So is this how lambda flows that describes my trajectory like that. So this line is called world line. It's an important word. Lambda is the parameter which parameterizes so it can be basically anything. Good choice is proper time, but as long as the trajectory is, you know, if I increase lambda I go this way, it's fine. So if I increase lambda I go that way, it's a not good parameter, and I better choose something else. Okay, so at each point I can define the velocity of the particle, dx mu over d lambda, basically how my coordinates change when I change the parameter lambda. And this is called parametric for velocity. So now you have three possibilities. So I define an interval ds square equal to my metric eta mu nu dx mu over d lambda dx nu over d lambda, and I look at the value of this, and this is either positive, negative, or zero. So I have three possibilities. So if it is bigger than zero, I call such a trajectory, space-like trajectory.
D lambda square.
Lambda square, if you want. Yeah, thanks. Okay, thank you so much. So if it is positive, then you call the trajectory space-like. What it means that the slope actually goes more to the right or left than it goes up or down. So this would be space-like trajectory. So unfortunately, there are no such particles in physics, but if you have string theory, there's something called tachyon, which may propagate. So this means that the particle propagates with the velocity which is higher than the speed of light. So there is a possibility, but you know, it's very questionable. So now if it is equal to zero, the trajectory is called null or light-like. And as the name suggests, this is how light travels. So for light, we proved it in yesterday's tutorial, that actual electromagnetic waves, for them, k mu square equals to zero, right? So it's precisely the same thing here. So if you have zero distance, zero space-time distance, it's light propagation. And finally, if it's smaller than zero, okay, then you call it time-like, and these are physical massive particles. Of course, there is a trick. Here, it depends on which signature I'm using. So here, I'm using the signature that eta mu nu is minus plus plus plus. If I switch the signature, this will be switched. So this will be smaller than zero one, but the name remains the same, right? So I just switch these. Okay, questions? No. Okay. So now it happens that no matter which frame you look at, this will still be true. So if I do my Lorentz transformation to my coordinates x mu, you know, the value, well, x mu changes, but this guy doesn't change. So, you know, if the trajectory is time-like in one coordinate frame, it is time-like in the other one as well. Okay, so now, especially for time-like curves or trajectories, you define d tau, which is the proper time, which is the square root of this, dx mu dx nu. So now, obviously, this guy doesn't have any indices, so it's Lorentz invariant. And so it's Lorentz invariant, and tau is called proper time. So another important word to remember. So now what it is equal to? Okay, let me start here. So d tau equals to, so now I pull 1 over c. And you remember that the coordinates x mu are ct and xi, right? So, okay, so I write it like 1 over c square root of minus eta mu nu. Now I borrow t dt, so I put it here. And then I return it back, right? Okay, so now x0 is ct. And eta 0, 0 is minus 1. So this is equal to dt integral 1 from the 0, 0 component and minus 1 over c square dxi over dt square. Or in other words, so dxi over dt is how you define standard velocity. So this is vi square. So it's v square. So this is dt 1 minus v square. And of course, so now you can rewrite it in terms of this gamma factor in the Lorentz transformation. So this is dt over gamma.
It should be 1 minus v squared over c squared.
V squared over c squared, yes. Thank you.
Because we have not said c
squared. That's right, that's right. Thank you. V squared over c squared. So now what you define is, so we defined before, we defined parametric for velocity, which was with respect to any parameter lambda. So now I told you that it's better to define with respect to tau, with respect to the proper time. So then it's called just for velocity. So denoted by u mu again. Well, I didn't know that one. So u mu is dx mu over d tau. So now x mu, dx mu behaves like a vector. D tau is a scalar. So this is a vector, so that's fine. You can rewrite it if you want in terms of t. So dx mu over dt, dt over d tau. Okay. So now I know what dt over d tau is. That's gamma. I calculated it above. So it will be gamma times something. And now x0 is ct. If I differentiate with respect to t, I get c. And dxi over dt is the velocity. So it's velocity v. Yeah, so this is the form of the four velocity. And you can check if you want to that u mu equals to minus c square. So now there is a statement which I will not prove to you. If you want, you can look into Z. It's a complicated proof, very involved one. Beautiful one, but yeah. A particle mass d depends on the velocity. On the velocity. And so what is true that if I have mass in the reference frame which is moving with, well, if the particle is moving with velocity v, then its mass will be given by this Lorentz factor gamma times the rest mass. So m0 is the rest mass. Meaning that if I measure the mass of the particle at rest, this will be true. Problem? Question? No? Okay, so proof is easy if you are interested. Okay, another quantity is for momentum. For momentum, which you define to be p mu. Basically, you take your rest mass, which is a scalar, and multiply by u mu. And that's the definition of the four momentum. So now what it's equal to, so I use this expression for u mu and multiply by m0. Okay? So what I get is gamma m0c and gamma m0v. Okay, so now I use that relation that actually the mass is gamma times m0. So this I will call mass. This I will call mass. So what stands in the first component is mc. But you derived yesterday in your tutorial that the energy is mc square, right? So what stands here is the energy divided by c. Okay, so this equals to energy divided by c. And then m times v is just the momentum, right? So this is the result. Just taking what you already know from yesterday. Okay, so now what is useful is to calculate p square, which is p mu, and then you can calculate it in two different frames. This is a scalar, so it has no indices. So this index is contracted, so it's a scalar, so the value must be same in all reference frames. So let's calculate it first in the rest frame. So in the rest frame, if you look at here, then in the rest frame, gamma equals to 1. So I have m0c here, and here v is 0. So this guy is 0. And so if I calculate that, I get that this is equal to minus m0 c square in the rest frame. Okay. So now I can calculate it in other frame. Now using this expression here. So I get that this must be equal to minus e square over c square plus p vector square. Huh? M0 square, yeah. Thank you. Oh, very good, very good. Okay, so now I can rearrange this equation. So I can solve it for E, right? So I have left hand side equals to right hand side. So from here I see that E equals to C times P vector square plus M0 square C square. Just rearranging that equation which I have over there, which I can rewrite if you want. I can pull this M0 C square out. So I'll have M0 C square. So one C coming from here, another C coming from there. 1 plus P over M0 C square. And that's your formula for the energy. And now what Neil showed you yesterday is that this is basically what you already know from. So now if I have small velocities, small momenta, then I can expand that. So this is approximately equal to. So this is approximately equal to m0 c square, now 1 plus 1 half p square over m square c square. Which is equal to m0 c square plus 1 half p square over 2 m0. Okay, so this is your rest energy of the particle, and this is your kinetic energy. Huh? Yeah. Okay, very good. Oh, so many mistakes. Very good. It keeps you aware that I'm doing mistakes. That's perfect. Keep correcting me, please. So now this formula works even for m0 equal to 0. So if I plug in the formula m0 equal to 0, I get that E equals to Cp, which is the formula I started with yesterday. So we are actually going in circles around. So, but anyway, everything can be proved if you want to. So this is for photons or whatever. Well, if you have rest mass equal to 0. Okay, so that's kinematics. So that is all to know about. So kinematics is how my trajectory looks like, how to describe it, what is for velocity, what is for momentum. So now to make your mechanics complete, you need also dynamics. So you need how this trajectory is determined, right? So dynamics. And of course, this is given by the Newton law. So you promote your normal force to a four force and call it F mu. Why not? And then the Newton law is that this is the change of the momentum. And I need this to be a vector. So I have dp mu over d tau. And this is my equation which governs the motion. So I'll find p mu by solving this equation, provided that I know what my four force is. So for example, you already know the example that f mu is equal to q times f mu nu, u nu, which is the Lorentz force, right? Okay, so that's an example. So I can find how my trajectory looks like if I have a charged particle in electromagnetic field.
You got one free index, but apparently you contracted both your indices there. So where does the
what do you mean? So f mu nu, this is u.
Oh.
Sorry, this is u and this is u of nu. Good, good. So now one thing which is quite interesting, let us calculate what f times u is, right? So that's, okay, let me write it. Eta mu nu, f mu, u nu. Let me use this Newton's law. Okay, so so this equals to eta mu nu, u nu, d p mu over d tau, right? But now I have two terms. So p mu is defined, okay, it's hiding there, but it was defined m0 times u mu, right? So now differentiating that, I'll get two terms. So this is eta mu nu u nu d m0 over d tau u mu. And the other term is eta mu nu u nu m0 d u mu d tau. Let me put m0 here. So I have these two terms. Okay. So now the question is, what is this?
Newtonian force.
Who said zero? Ah, why? Perfect. So this is equal to zero because you know that u mu equals to 1 minus c square. So now if I differentiate this with respect to tau, right? So if I d over d tau on this, and as well as here, then here I get zero. And here I get two terms like that, right? So which are exactly the same terms. So it's two times u mu d u mu over d tau. So that's why this guy is actually zero. Very good. So now this guy here is minus c square. So I see that f dot u is minus c square dm 0 over d tau. Okay, so what does it mean? It means that if f dot u is not perpendicular, well, if f is not perpendicular to u, if f dot u is not equal to 0, then my rest mass is changing by pushing the when that force pushes. So now you can check that actually this is not the case here, because f dot u, so you would have f mu nu, u nu, u mu. Okay, so. Okay, so statement is if f is not perpendicular to u, then m0 changes. Okay, but this is not the case of electromagnetic force. Because you know that f dot u there is q times u mu, u nu, f mu nu. And so this guy is symmetric in mu and nu. This guy is antisymmetric in mu and nu. And symmetric times antisymmetric is zero. If you haven't seen that, think about it. So this is actually zero. So electromagnetic force doesn't change the rest mass, but there are other forces which do change the rest mass. And the condition is that f dot u is not perpendicular. Questions, comments?
Does this have any, could you connect it somehow to the way we describe work? Classically, if a force is perpendicular, it does not do work on the particle, right?
And if
the force and the velocity are, well, they're not perpendicular, then somehow work is being done. And does that somehow sap, take away the mass as the energy in the form?
I think it could be related to that. Well, what you can do is that you can prove that the zero component of the force is something like, I think, energy pair. Okay, I'll have to think about it, but I think it's related to this. Yeah, probably. Okay, section two, happy times. You start GR. So first look. Exciting times. At part A, there will be conceptual. Pass to the theory. That's a question? Okay. So let us return back to the time when Einstein was thinking about space and time and about gravity and stuff like that. And so first, he was able to unify space and time and basically invented special relativity. And of course, this the special relativity was in contradiction. So it was in perfect accordance with Maxwell theory. But it was in contradiction with the Newton's gravity theory, right? So actually, there were two hints. So next step for Einstein was to invent you know, a field theory for the gravity. Okay, so he had basically two things, and so he wanted a field theory for Newtonian interaction or for gravity. So why Newtonian gravity is inconsistent with special relativity is immediately obvious, because you have the Newton's force law, which is g times m1 m2 over the distance square, right? So this is an action at a distance, right? So it's instantaneous force. So something happens here, and a particle there immediately knows that something happened here. But of course, due to special relativity, this is not possible, because you have finite speed of propagation. C is the maximum velocity you can have. So if something happened in the sun, it takes more at least 8 minutes before we actually know about it on the surface of the Earth. So this is actually inconsistent with that. So he wanted to eliminate instantaneous action at a distance. And of course, he was, you know, very much impressed with the Maxwell theory. And so he was looking at a similar thing which you could find in the Maxwell theory. And of course, it is the Coulomb law, right? So if you have electrostatic field, let me call it Coulomb law, then there's some constant Q1, Q2 over R square, right? And these two laws of physics look very much alike, right? So this is, again, instantaneous force, which is action at a distance. There's no knowledge about the propagation of light. There's no knowledge of C here. But we know that this guy is only a static limit of Maxwell theory, right? So he thought, well, this is a static limit of some field theory which describes gravity. So this was basically his thinking. I want to upgrade this guy. I want to create field theory for gravity so that this is a static limit of that. Okay. So that was first thought. And the second thought is that he didn't like the notion of absolute space. So he was thinking about relativity of notion, a very old concept introduced by Galilei. And then Lorentz was thinking about it, but Galilei didn't take it seriously, despite that he invented that. Lorentz was not taking it seriously, and only Einstein actually took it seriously, that there is something like relativity of motion. So now there are two ways how you can actually perceive your space-time or your space. So you can perceive it as an absolute quantity, something which is there despite whatever, well, anything can be happening in that space, but the space is there on its own. It's a physical quantity on its own. And actually, this was the view taken by Newton. And I'll explain you in a minute why actually Newton came with this idea. But long before Newton, this was, you know, so this idea existed before Newton, but it was not the dominant idea actually in science. So there was this other one. It's actually space as a relation. So, and this was the view of Aristotle, Descartes, and many others. So this was the dominant idea. And what it says is that it doesn't make any sense to talk about absolute space, right? Why it should exist? What it means, what makes sense is actually to talk about the things which are in the space and how they are related. What is the relation of the things? Meaning, this guy is next to that guy is next to that guy, and that forms my space. And then it's air here, and so it's the relation between things which actually makes sense to talk about, right? And consequently, you can have a motion which is AD absolute. Absolute motion is something that it makes sense to talk about that I go from one point of the space to another point of the space, despite whatever is inside that space. So this motion is absolute also. So there exists an absolute space, and it makes sense to talk about I go from that point of the space to that point of the space, or it's a relative motion. And again, it makes sense to talk about that I actually, you know, I'm passing the blackboard, right? So I'm moving with respect to the blackboard. That's my motion. Because I'm passing these things locally, I'm moving, right? So in this relative notion, so going from contiguity, I don't know how to pronounce this word, contiguity of space, of one object to contiguity of another object. Question? Okay.
So absolute space and absolute motion work together, and the the concept of space as a relation, the relative.
Yeah.
But didn't Newton also subscribe to who was that guy? Galileo.
Right.
Idea about relative motion.
Okay, but he didn't take it seriously.
He didn't.
You know, he basically rejected it, and I will explain you why in a minute. So yeah. He knew about Galileo's work.
But isn't that inbuilt into Newtonian mechanics?
Well, not really. Okay, I'll explain in a minute. So, but anyway, so Newton definitely assumes an absolute space, and it makes sense to talk about, even if in that space is nothing there, it makes sense to talk about I go from that point of the space to that point of the space, and I move absolutely with respect to that space. Okay, so now Newton was aware that something wrong is going here. And that's why he devised an ingenious argument why there must be an absolute space. And that argument prevailed 300 years. And nobody was able to defeat it. So, and this is basically like first thought experiment, if you want. And that's called Newton's bucket. I don't know if Newton actually owned any bucket, but the situation is very simple. Imagine that you have a bucket full of water, and you put that bucket on a cord, and that cord, you twist that cord. And at one point, you release it, right? So what happens that the bucket starts rotating like that, right? So let's say at t equal to time, at t equal to 0, I have my bucket, which is on that cord. And that bucket is rotating because I just released the cord and it starts rotating. But of course, the water, so that bucket is full of water. And that water, when I release the bucket, doesn't rotate, right? It takes some time before the water starts rotating because of the friction. But if I release it at one point, so the water is still, so this is still, the surface of the water is flat, right? But the bucket is rotating. Okay, so after some time, so now the time passes, then due to the friction, the water starts rotating inside the bucket as well. So now we have both bucket and the water rotating. So what happens is that the water forms a concave shape, right? So now bucket is rotating and the water is rotating as well. And I have concave shape. Okay. So now Newton says, why do we observe this concave shape? Well, everybody knows it's because of the rotation of the water. So concavity is due to the rotation of the water. So first, the water was not rotating. We saw flat surface, and now the water is rotating. That's why we see that surface of the water. Okay, but when you talk about when you talk about rotation, then you want to know rotation with respect to what? So rotation with respect to what? And that's a crucial question. So now if Aristotle is right, and Descartes is right, and all these people are right, that it must be rotation with respect to some quantity which is close by that water. So what is close by? The bucket. Okay, so.
I don't think Aristotle ever said that it had to be close by.
Sorry?
I don't think Aristotle ever held that it had to be close by.
Okay, let's put Descartes. He thought it's close by. So Descartes thought, well, so it must be the bucket, right? Because that thing, so I define my motion of the water with respect to some close by quantity, some close by object, and that must be the bucket, because that's what surrounds my water. But of course, this is completely wrong, right? Because if that were the case, here, there is a relative motion of water and the bucket, because bucket is rotating, but water is not, right? So there is a relative motion of these two quantities, but we don't observe that concave case. So it cannot the concave shape. So it cannot be this case here. And what about here? Here both things are rotating, bucket and the water. Which means that there is no relative motion of these two quantities. So it cannot be right. Okay. Yeah?
Isn't it rotating with respect to the top of the string?
It's not close by enough apparently according to Newton.
That's right.
What's going on?
Okay, so what was that? okay, so that was Newton's argument. So Newton say, here comes Newton, and he says, well, the rotation is respect to the absolute space. There is some absolute space. And A, the water is still with respect to the absolute space, and that's why it has flat shape, or it is rotating with respect to that absolute space. And that's why it has this shape. Okay. So Newton, it's with respect to the absolute space. And he used this as a proof of the existence of the absolute space. So now, of course, people didn't like that, right? So people like Leibniz and many others, they're very much in opposition to the absolute space and to this idea that there's something absolute without talking about anything else. But they couldn't defeat this argument. Nobody could for 300 years. And people tried. Okay. So now, in 19th century, Mach comes. And he says, so Mach was a philosopher in Prague, and he had lots of crazy ideas. And this is one of them. Actually, it's complete nonsense, probably. But anyway, what is good about this is that actually it's inspired Einstein to come to invent general relativity, basically. So Mach says, well, it's rotation with respect to the full matter content of the universe. So basically what he says is, so while we know that this has something to do with the inertial, the notion of the inertia, right? So he says, well, there wouldn't be any inertia if there were no other matter in the universe. He says, well, inertia is only a property which is created when we have other matter in the universe. So basically, you know, it's a motion with respect to the distant stars. That's what he says. So he has this very strange idea. So inertia caused by distant stars. And actually, people gave this idea, you know, a physics formulation. I think it's something like shape dynamics now. So anyway, by distant stars. So there wouldn't be any inertia. There wouldn't be that shape if there were no distant stars. Or if you had your bucket, which would be infinitely massive, if you had really huge bucket. So in this case, the bucket is rotating and the water is rotating. So he says there wouldn't be that shape because the inertia is with respect to the relative motion of these things, but it would be not moving, right? So there wouldn't be that shape. So he says if there is only bucket in the universe and the water, we wouldn't observe this. But what Einstein took from here is that really the matter content of the universe matters. That's what causes actually things to happen. So now here comes Einstein and uses this stupid idea. Einstein. And what he says, well, what he liked is that the matter can cause something to happen, right? That the matter has influence on what is happening here. That's what he liked. What he didn't like is this action at a distance, right? That there is this distant star which actually determines whether my bucket is rotating, whether my water is, has that shape or that shape. So he didn't like that. So he wanted something local. And so what he came with is that he says it's local, so it rotates with respect to what? With respect to the local physical quantity but what is there? What is local there? So it's not a bucket, right? But there is a gravitational field. So he said it's with respect to the local gravitational field.
But it is rotating at a faster rate compared to it, because if it's on the ground, then the ground is rotating and the bucket is rotating with it. But if you consider
the point is that you could then talk about the ground and then like essentially a meaningful question about whether the ground itself is rotating or not.
What if the ground were rotating really fast?
No, but are there any meaningful questions when you get to philosophy?
Newton and Einstein thought so. Like, you're welcome to disagree.
No.
Why should be an acceleration defined? Okay, so he said, well, he came with this idea. So there is locally a gravitational field everywhere. So it must be the interaction between the water and the gravitational field. What causes this shape and that shape in that case? So that was his idea. But of course, he would have to think, okay, so but why actually this, you know, centrifugal force or whatever which we see, why the Newtonian acceleration which we see of the water should have anything to do with the gravitational field? And he was thinking about this. What is there in common with the gravitational field and the Newtonian acceleration? So that was the question. And the answer is the equivalence principle. So part B, so that was conceptual part of the theory. So part B is principle of equivalence. And I claim this is the answer to that question and why we can defeat Newton's argument about the bucket. And that's based on very simple observation. And the observation is that everybody on a high school knows this, at all bodies in a given gravitational field experience the same acceleration. Okay, and this is based on experiment which doesn't really work because Newton was throwing balls from the window or whatever, and he claims that if he throws a ball and if he throws a paper, they should fall the same. Of course, they don't because of the friction. But anyway, so he extrapolated from there. He says if there were no friction, they would actually fall the same. Okay, so now the simplest thing is that this is the Newton law, right? F equals to ma, and what this m stands for is the inertial mass, right? So basically this tells you if I apply the force, how much acceleration I get depends on this quantity m, right? So this is basically like a resistance for the force to cause the acceleration. It's called inertial mass. Okay, and in the simplest case, in the homogeneous gravitational field, this is equal to m times g, where this is the gravitational mass, right? So if I have gravity, if I apply gravity, then this mass tells me, how much gravity is effective to actually cause my body moving, right? So this is a gravitational mass. And this is an inertial mass. And they are, in principle, two completely different quantities, right? And they have nothing to do with each other. But what actually happens, and it's confirmed by the experiment, is that mi over mg is some fixed constant, which is constant for any matter content for anybody. So. Yeah?
You said it's verified experimentally, but. Experimentally, you can only access to local gravitational fields, right? And our gravitational field locally is almost uniform, right?
I agree. But it was measured to very high precision. There are, if you want to do experimental physics, this is the way, the subject to be involved in, because people are devising more and more complicated and more expensive experiments, how actually to prove that mi over mg is a constant. Right, so there are many experiments. If you want to read about it, yeah.
But the whole point is that if they're subjected to the same acceleration, you want to keep all other conditions constant, right? So you want to have all the objects at the same level so that they're subjected to the same gravitational field.
You can do the same experiment like twice in the same place.
And
you don't have to drop at the same time. You can just drop two in the same place in the same field and then time them.
And so what we got to from here, if this is true, then A equals to G, right? Trivial. And this trivial statement is called principle of equivalence. It's one version of principle of equivalence. Okay, so that's true. But now here comes Einstein and tries to explain why this is true, actually. And he designs an amazing experiment, which, again, thought experiment. So defeating Newton's bucket, we have new experiment, which is called Einstein elevator. And it will take 300 years to defeat this argument, I guess. Okay. And the statement is, let's imagine I have an elevator which doesn't have any windows or whatever, and inside that elevator there is a person. Okay, and the statement is I cannot distinguish, if he cannot see outside, if that elevator is actually moving with the acceleration equal to g upwards, or if that elevator is in our gravitational field. G. Right? The statement is that the experiments which that guy inside the elevator can perform are exactly the same in this frame or in that frame. So cannot distinguish these things. And that's a principle of equivalence. So let's try to have 5 minutes. So let's start at, what is it, 10? 1 minute to 10? OK. Yeah? Okay.
The first one is still when in, I mean, we're using ring recordings, right? Yeah. So we're just going from the scene, the particle,
the accelerator,
the red frame of the particle.
Yeah.
So I mean, so I can put my coordinates of the particle in the origin of the ring recordings.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, exactly.
So what it happens is that we are trying to get into this expression, but it's only valid whenever
gravity
the surface is going flat. Zero. Then you start spinning.
And the thing is that why the dynamic curve potential
Well, that's the finding you'll find. So there's no a priori reason why that should be solved. You're absolutely right. But you know, it's a miracle that if the particle's accelerating, so it produces some electric magnetic fields, whatever, right? So if you see from the normal frame, so, you know, if you have current, there's a B field. If you have accelerating something, then there's a radiation as well, there's electromagnetic waves everywhere. But now the mystery is that now I transform to the reference frame, which is actually I'm sit on that particle, and suddenly I see something like a Coulomb law.
Now, if you wait a while,
it's a finding of this calculation. It's not trivial. I don't think so. So what you have to do is so you place.
You can identify.
There must be something with respect to
B. No, that is not true.
Talk about rotation.
I will look at that, the catch maybe, but
well,
no,
thing
it's more right.
I don't quite see why you can say
in case of things, you can do the same experiment.
Okay, I'll look at that. I'll talk about it.
Just say bucket and by some mechanism
just starts rotating. But how do you start rotating?
Whatever.
Okay.
Just grab the bucket in outer space where there's nothing else and just go in.
Exactly.
Interpret
that. That's for large G. For small G, by magic it starts rotating.
Exactly.
Yeah.
As the Coulomb law. Yeah.
So what are you talking about?
No, it doesn't matter. That doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. No, it doesn't matter.
That's right.
No, you don't have to.
Well, it's a very good question what you are asking. Well, think about it a little bit more. So what happens is actually looks like this. So there's a charge here, and you have almost Coulomb law here. But then this gets distorted somehow and forms something like this. So this is a surface where the electromagnetic waves propagate. So the charge coming from right, so it irradiates electromagnetic waves, and these propagate at the speed of light. To the left of the particle.
Huh.
So this is actually the front of that speed of light propagating thing.
Cool.
So these are the waves which propagate. And now towards these things, there's this distorted electromagnetic field. So here you have something like static Coulomb law.
Well, no,
and here you have the wave which propagates to the left. And here is something in between. And they must match. Also, if you want to think about this, is that
weird.
This is a horizon.
What is weird?
So, you know,
those came from the New World.
This is, well, the particle propagated the waves, they propagated the speed of light, but here, nobody knows about it, that particle exists.
But there's something even more weird than this, and that this has for small values, no, for large values, G, this has a spectral reflection.
Yeah,
no. What do you mean?
if I have for small G, I have one.
That's right. Well, close to that, you have just a circle, but you still have that solution here.
It's amazing how much it's done in this game.
Okay.
I just want to... Those circles break into two.
What is this?
Center of the origin?
What?
Okay.
I have exactly the same potential lines, but reflected here. Increases as I
Emily, what's the problem with having absolute space? Like, conceptually, why did people not like it?
That's strange.
I don't know if you have time for me to...
Yeah, sure. Yeah, let's discuss this afterwards.
Yeah.
Do you have a question?
It serves no...
Yeah, sure.
But this is local. So in general, we have
I think I have a lot of reason to.
It's proportional.
Just because something.
Exactly.
But. This is also kind of locally, like, we observe it in the...
So it depends on R, but it's, for anybody it will be true. So anybody which is at that distance from the Earth or whatever would still experience the same acceleration, which is G over R squared. Gm of the Earth over R squared. Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
So as someone is in a modern scale,
it's a framework where the particle is at the origin and the space.
If I could do this non locally globally by doing this. I agree with that. That's definitely true, and I agree with that. It's not true that you can write always that. You can always get rid of gravity by going to an accelerated frame. You cannot. You cannot get rid of gravity by going to an accelerated frame. So this will be true. You know, so here I have gravity, and here I don't have gravity. I simulate my gravity by acceleration. And I'm saying these two things are equivalent. So in general, if you have non-uniform gravitational field, you cannot do that. You can do it only very locally. And then you're right.
It would be if this function...
Well, it would certainly have been most straightforward to make it work.
Well, the answer for this is it's actually general relativity. So, yeah, well, I don't know if somebody tried that, but I don't know if somebody tried this. But what we have is general relativity, which is the answer for this. So, okay, so can I start now? And, No, I have to start lecturing after that. All right, so let me start again. Ah, we are recording still. Very good. So this thought experiment basically tells you I can simulate my gravity by going to an accelerated frame, right? So these two pictures are completely equivalent as far as local experiments in the elevator are done. Okay? And it has several consequences, which are basically the whole GR. So first, gravitational redshift Okay, so now we will be drawing these pictures of people in the elevators. So let's assume that this is my elevator, which is on the surface of the Earth. So there's a gravitational field G. And that, let's assume that there's a little guy here who sends, who uses a flashlight and sends the light up that elevator. So it's a guy who sends a light up there. So in general, let's be open-minded, and let's say that the frequency down there of that light is omega, and the frequency up there, as measured by the guy up, is omega prime. And let's assume that the experiment is done, that the height difference is delta H for these things. Okay, so now, if omega is different from omega prime, we have, you know, the gravitational field changes the frequency of the wave. Okay, so now we can look at this from a different point of view.
How does the gravitational field change the frequency?
We will just prove this. We will just prove that in a minute. Give me a minute. I'll prove this. Okay, so now let's assume that, oh no. So this is my elevator. And I simulate my gravity by accelerating that elevator up. Okay, so again, delta H here. So now if my elevator is accelerating, so that what it means is it moves upwards. So after some time, the elevator will be a little bit up, right? Okay, so now what is the difference here? So if the time is t, then this distance will be 1/2 gt square, right? So now I do the same experiment. So I shine the light. Up there. So the elevator is moving with the velocity, which is equal to g times t. So I send the light up, and it takes time t to reach the up point. But by the time the elevator actually moves up a little bit by distance 1/2 gt square and has the velocity gt up there, right? So I have an equation at ct. So the distance traveled by the light is delta h plus 1/2 gt square. That is the original plus the distance the elevator made. Okay, and v equals to gt. So now, of course, I will take delta h very small, which means t is very small. But if t is very small, then this guy, well, acceleration is very weak on the surface of the Earth, right? So I can basically neglect this term when plugging into this relation already. So here, I express t, so g. And instead of t, I solve that equation. It's a quadratic equation for t. But let's make it even simpler. Let's make it linear, right? So I forget about that term at this point. And it's consistent approximation. So t is delta h over c. OK, that's my velocity of the elevator up. OK, so now we know that the wave vector of the light sent down here from yesterday's tutorial is omega c 0, 0. And this is sent in the z direction. So this is your wave vector sent here. So now the light travels up there and hits the observer, which is however now moving with the velocity v up. So I can use special relativity to actually find out what is the frequency of that thing. So up there, I'll have k mu prime, which is omega prime over c, 0, 0, omega prime over c, which is what you had yesterday. And you found yesterday in your tutorial that this is equal to gamma omega over c, 1 minus beta, 1, 0, 0, 1. This is what you found yesterday. So what does it mean? Is that my new frequency omega prime, OK, so omega prime equals to, now I compare what I see here with what I see here. So omega prime equals to gamma times omega times 1 minus beta. Beta is 1 over c, or gamma is the gamma factor, Lorentz gamma factor. Okay. So that's my frequency. So now I have done some approximations in this calculation. I'm saying t is small, velocity is small, and blah, blah, blah. If velocity is small, gamma is 1. So this is omega times 1 minus beta, right? Which is omega times 1, beta is v over c, v is this guy, delta h g over c, and this is over c, so over c square. So I claim that the frequency perceived by the observer up there, due to this Lorentz boost or whatever, is this frequency there. Okay, so now you define a quantity which you call gravitational redshift. Gravitational redshift, and that is, it's usually called z, and it's just the difference of the frequencies divided by the original frequency. So it's the new frequency minus the old frequency divided by the old frequency. Okay, so this is omega prime over omega minus 1. Now I see omega prime over omega is 1 minus this guy here, minus 1 is this guy here. So this is equal to minus delta h g over c square. So first I see that this is negative, meaning that the frequency up there will be smaller than the frequency down there. Right? So what I draw here, and now, so you calculate it in this frame, but this must be completely equivalent to what the guy here sees. So what it means is that gravitational field actually, you know, changes the frequency of the wave. So it actually, so the photon has to climb up the gravitational potential, and as it climbs up, it loses the energy. So the frequency here is smaller than the frequency there. Okay. So, okay. Questions? So the answer is that photons have lower frequency, so they are redder. How many d's? 1d, 2d's, redder? Some English? 2? Redder up there. Are redder up there. So, what kind of experiments theoreticians do if they don't have anything, right? They have only flashlight and they have a tower. So all you need a tower and flashlight to almost get Nobel Prize. Okay. And there's a pound and replica. One of them was graduate student. And they devised in 1960s. They said, well, they had a tower. Well, delta h was 22.6 meters. So it's not even high tower, right? It's very. Okay, great. Thank you. Okay, so delta h is that thing. So now, if you calculate this z, okay, so this is 2.3 times 10. Now, so I'm plugging that formula. So delta h is 2.3 times 10 meters. G is 10. So 2.3 times 10 to the 2 meters. And then you need c square. So c is 3 times 10 to the 8. 3 times 10 to the 8 square. Okay. So this is roughly, if you do the math, it's 10 to the minus 15. Not very much, but still measurable. So actually, they measured that if you send your light up there, then the frequency actually changes according to this formula, and they proved that. Okay, and they observed that. So if you're a graduate student and you don't have any, you know, expensive experiments, then this is a good thing to do. So now, last thing. So this was experimentally confirmed, 1960, very famous experiment. So now, the frequency of the wave is basically, so if I have my wave like that and has some frequency omega, well, let's put proportional to, then what I measure is how long it takes for, you know, the proper time between the peaks, right? So the frequency will be proportional to 1 over delta tau, okay? So what does it mean? Is that because the frequency of the wave changes, the delta tau changes, right? So actually, your proper time elapses differently in, you know, if you are close to the gravitating object than if you are far away in the space where there is no gravity. Okay, so in strong gravitational fields, time ticks more slowly.
But are we not making the assumption in this that throughout the length of the tower, the gravitational field strength stays the same?
Yes.
It could vary by a small amount, right?
Okay. That's fair enough, but basically the argument is that you have to climb that potential. In reality, we don't have uniform gravitational field, right? This is just an approximation, right? So there will be weaker gravitational field up there.
But you can have an average. You can define an average over the distance and then work accordingly.
Just gotta see how big is the change with that distance, and if it's comparable with.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah. Exactly.
What exactly does it mean? Time ticks more slowly.
Okay, so
watch.
If I am up there,
yes,
and I measure the time on my watch, I say that actually my time elapses more slowly than of that guy who is down there. If I compare the times, the other way. If I'm down there, time elapses more slowly than if I'm up there. So of course, if I go down there, it will be exactly the same. So if I move down there,
so if you go up there and you come back down, your watch will be behind.
Yeah. If I spend a lot of time there, then I'll be older than the guy. So anyway, so Neil gave you this great idea that in order to stay young, you should move fast. So now I say in order to stay young, you should move fast and you should sleep too close to some heavy object. So for example, sleeping in the library is a good thing because there is lots of So move fast. And sleep in the library. But only if it has very many heavy books, right? Sleep in the library.
Not everything makes sense.
Sorry, David, can you go over again why time ticks more slowly? Because I think Saad pointed this out, but we have the same gravitational field in that thought experiment.
Yeah, but the frequency changes. Yeah. So yeah, think about it. That you have to climb up the potential there.
No, if g is constant down here and up there, time will pass the same rate. If there's a heavy planet and I'm away from the heavy planet, then yeah, I could see a clock going slower on the heavy planet, but not if it's a constant g.
Oh, maybe I'm cheating here a little bit. Yeah.
It's the gravitational potential that matters. Like at different gravitational potentials, you get different frequencies for light and therefore different rates of ticking for clocks that depend on light.
Yeah.
So what's the answer? If it's a constant g, will I still time slowly down there and then up there?
This is not a very good way of putting it because it makes it sound as if you're talking about all kinds of clocks. Like all you're showing in this case is for clocks that works based on the frequency of light.
But so the clock is a clock, right? Each peak is a tick.
No,
So maybe the last thing, so second consequence, which I'll not do any calculation. So second consequence will be bending of light. So you can immediately predict from here that that the trajectory of the light will be curved. So imagine that I have an elevator again, which is moving up there. So I simulate my gravity like that, and I shine a light into that elevator. So from here. So now that light actually moves in a straight line from outside, right? So it moves in the straight line. So now when the light is here, my bottom of the elevator is here. So now after some time, the light will be here, but my elevator moves a little bit up. So I will measure that distance to the bottom. After some time, this guy will be here and the elevator will be here. The bottom of the elevator will be there. So if I'm the observer inside that elevator, I see actually that the trajectory of that light is curved and it goes down, right? So this is completely equivalent to saying that in the chi. Right? So you immediately predict that that light must be bending. Yeah, whatever it is, it is bent. Okay, so gravity changes what it means for a path to be straight. Okay. So now this is obvious, right? So straight line without gravity is not straight line with gravity. Okay. So just a remark. So without G, I see straight line. So I see this. So if there's no G now, then I just see in my elevator a straight line. But by the same argument as I was simulating my gravity or whatever, so if I am in gravitational field, my light is bended due to the gravitational field. But now elevator is now falling down. Right, so the elevator falls down, then I would see the straight line again. Okay, so.
But if it was falling down.
So can get rid of gravity. Mm-hmm. By going to a freely falling elevator. Falling elevator. And this guy is called local inertial frame. Okay, well, let's stop here. We have many more to cover. Questions?
You can get a rest by just using a conservation of energy, so like, why bother to use all these traps? It seems you can get all these redshift or something by just using a conservation of energy. And why do you use
it? You mean, yeah,
you have to use the.
You can use some cheating argument. This is also cheating. But you can cheat even more by using conservation of energy. I agree with that. But. Yeah, but that's not correct calculation. It's a lot of cheating. You can do that, but it's a lot of cheating. Well, I can present that argument tomorrow if you want to. I'll present it tomorrow, but it's not, not everything is right.